From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center.
It seems to me immensely unfair to think of feminist criticism as a way of narrowing the focus through which we look at texts. Quite the contrary is true. It's a way of broadening the focus immensely. Feminist criticism should not be defined, I think, in opposition to men's studies. Feminist criticism is a way of reading not just women in a text, women as subject, women as writers, but men, too. It's a way of reading commentaries on humane existence.
As recent political developments suggest, the impact of feminism upon American society is measurable by various yardsticks, among them cultural and literary criticism. What are some implications of feminism for the production and study of literature in both historical and contemporary terms? Soundings now presents the second in a series of discussions about women's literary studies. The panelists in the following portion of the conversation are Patricia Spax, Deborah Kaplan, Leila Ahmed, and Joan Stewart. Patricia Spax is a professor of English at Yale University. She's the author of a forthcoming study about gossip as a form of social and literary discourse, a project she completed during a fellowship at the National Humanities Center. Deborah Kaplan teaches at George Mason University, where she specializes in literary studies about 19th century England. Leila Ahmed is a professor of women's studies at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, she worked on a project about women in the Middle East. Joan Stewart teaches French language and literature at North Carolina State University. As a fellow of the National Humanities Center, she worked on a book about 18th century French women novelists. Here is Patricia Spax.
I take feminist to refer to the movement which assumes that women are their own centers of experience, that women are the subjects of their own experience. And feminist criticism is the literary criticism which proceeds from that assumption. It seems to me that there are two particularly important aspects to the movement right now. One is the aspect that has come out of French theory and criticism in recent years, which concentrates on problems of language and which has raised the question of whether women have a language of their own which can be identified, or whether it's possible for women to develop a language of their own which they can use. The theory behind this is that language in general is male language, that males have had possession of language for the past centuries, and that this is a problem that women need to think about. The movement that is more common, or has until recently at any rate been more common in this country, is more centered on the question of experience and on dealing with the ways in which women's experience has been treated in literature, and the ways in which it hasn't been treated in literature, both by women writers and by male writers.
Deborah Kaplan, tell us about feminism and your investigations into 19th century British literature.
The tradition of Austen biography writing has suggested that nothing happened to Jane Austen, and consequently, it's been somewhat difficult for these biographers to explain how it is that she came to write the wonderful novels that she wrote. Admittedly, production, the act of production, is difficult to get hold of, but I believe that she has been described as dull, a spinster, because of the attitude that writers have had towards women who, in fact, never married or who were very closely tied to their families and to the activities of their families. What feminism and feminist literary criticism has enabled me to do is nothing short of sort of reviewing, reperceiving Austen's life experience. I'm trying to look at her experience as part of a woman's culture that existed for her, and I'm trying to suggest that the activities that she took part in were not, in fact, trivial. They're only trivial depending on the perspective you take in looking at them, and I believe that perspective has been patriarchal. They are, in fact, very meaningful activities, and they enable us to get some sense of how her life experience was transported into and transformed in her literary works. For example, a number of literary critics have suggested that Austen's own works are, her own novels, are about unimportant subjects, that they are limited. And I try to show that, in fact, she had herself a double consciousness of the nature of her experiences. On the one hand, she saw domestic life, her interactions with other women, as very valuable, and the small details of everyday life, whether it be making wine, for example, or gardening, she saw these as important activities. But she also understood how her activities would be viewed by, were being viewed by the culture at large, and I think this produces a very complex and ironic consciousness on her part, because she holds these two views at once, and those two views do make their way into her her novels, so that her attitude towards the small details of everyday life is, on the one hand, you know, she makes use of these events in highly important, emblematic ways in her novels. A carriage ride and the way a man and woman take that ride tells you a good deal about their marriage. Her valuation of the small events of everyday life play an important fictional role in her novels. At the same time, there is an awareness, I think, in the novels that women's lives are constricted, and that they that their activities, when contrasted with those of their more active male peers, would be seen as diminished.
Leila Ahmed, what about feminist literary studies and women in the Middle East?
My feminist perspective has done in looking at Middle Eastern history and asking the questions of what has been the roles of women and how have they been thought of and what have they performed, how have they been part of this society. And I think there isn't an aspect of Islamic religion or civilization or culture that has not been transformed for me as I've been working as a result of that perspective. And I think the effect is very much like watching a play in which there's a dialogue going on, and so far you've been hearing the lines and seeing the image of only one of the speakers. And if you reread Islamic history to understand what the other person was saying, or where what she looked like, or what the character that you do see is responding to, it transforms actually what we have. I mean, the nature of history, the way we look at history, how we understand history, and how Islam has defined itself. But it's much more than beyond simply saying it. For instance, I'll give you two examples from two different eras in which I've been looking at recently. One is the time of Muhammad, the rise of Islam itself. It makes an enormous difference. It's been a fact that's well known and is repeated, but never given any attention as to what it actually means, that one of the major area in which Islam brought law reform, Muhammad instituted new laws, was in the area of personal relations. Another way of saying that is in the area of controlling women, male control of women. And that, in fact, is exactly what the center of the revolution, which was Islam, was as to how to reorganize society and fundamentally how to reorganize the unit in which a man and woman relate, which is the family unit. And that was transformed, and therefore, I mean, if it is passingly mentioned by non-feminist critics, as this is one of the areas, but let's go on to the serious business of the his military conquest and so on. Another example is from a different area, a different era, is rather later in Islam, when slavery was such an important aspect of Islamic society, and slaves were so plentiful. I mean, they were continually being captured from non-Islamic areas. It soon became you could then take a woman at a very early age, or the child at the age of 5, and train her rigorously in all a whole host of forms of ways of pleasing men and arts and skills, including artistic ones. And 10 years later, sell her to the you know, the ruling class, male ruling class. Now that meant that very soon you did not need. Women were mass-produced like any other women who were consumable by the upper classes. Now, and how does that affect culture? That means that these people were the elite, the people who defined what culture was. And what? How does it affect a man's psyche to be relating always to somebody who's his slave? And what kind of culture does that generate? So in every way, it's not only how did men look at women, but what kind of culture have we got as a result of this?
Joan Stewart has been looking at 18th-century French women novelists.
I think my own project can be described in two phases. The first was essentially historical. It was the determination to discover or to uncover a great many female novelists of the late 18th century who were enormously popular in their day, but who have been more or less systematically excluded from the literary canon since that time. Some of them were re-edited as late as the early 19th century, and then they just fell by the wayside. The late 18th century in France saw a great proliferation of novels by women and of extremely successful novels, successful by all the standards which are presently available to us, including numbers of editions, numbers of re-editions, critical notices and reviews, translations, and all the rest. And yet very little had been said about these novels since that time. Virginia Woolf has commented that before the late 18th century, in England, there were strange intermissions of speech and silence in women's writing. It seems to me that by this period in France, that the novels by women, writing by women, has become indeed continuous. And I wanted to explore the kind of novels that were appearing and talk about them, partly in historical terms and partly in literary terms. Once I began rereading those novels, though, I found I was reading them in ways that had been made possible by feminist criticism of the past few years, and I was discovering things that I hadn't really intended to look for. I began to discern particular forms of expression, particular symbols of repression, a repressed commentary on oppression in these novels. I began to find oscillating forms of compliance and defiance with literary expectations as well as with social expectations. In other words, a challenge to literary conventions, just as the heroines within the novels were challenging social conventions. And so the project itself was modified in the light of what I was discovering. And then I began to look for the ways in which these novels converged as well as the ways in which they diverged, and discovered that there were just as many examples of the former as of the latter. I spoke earlier about the next phase of my own reading of these novels, which was the comparison of what I was finding in them with what male critics have found in them, both in the late 18th century and in the 19th, and even, in fact, up till the early 20th century when there was still some commentary on the novels. And it seemed to me that the traditional critics were in some ways painting a cage around the consciousness of these women writers, although they were gilding the cage with the language of decorum and purity. They were refusing to see what became more and more clear to me, which is that women writers were using language in a special way to express special things.
Leila Ahmed.
Yes, I think what Jones said is important because it implies that what feminist criticism is doing is asking more questions of the text, and it's not out to reduce the text in any way. And to ask questions is not a reduction, it's always an enrichment.
Patricia Spax.
It's as though experience has simply forced a feminist point of view on us. I am probably 10 to 12 years older than anybody else around this table, and for me, I was in early middle age when it suddenly came upon me that the stories that I was hearing from my friends bore a singular relationship to what I was reading in literature. I had never noticed before, nobody appeared ever to have noticed before, that books by women, writing by women, was in some significant way different from writing by men. The canonical text by women that I had studied in college, it came down to Emily Dickinson, George Eliot, and Jane Austen. I don't really think that I'm forgetting anything. What we learned was that Emily Dickinson wrote little tiny poems which she kept in the bureau drawer, and this was a kind of emblem of what women's writing was like. It was something that was hidden and that was very, very small. That Jane Austen wrote about trivial and confined subjects and never mentioned the Napoleonic Wars, which were raging at the time that she wrote, and that George Eliot had to take a male pseudonym. In every case, although these women were considered important enough writers that they were studied in college, the point about them seemed to be that they were in some significant way lesser than men and in no other way significantly different except more trivial in their concerns. And the point at which it suddenly became apparent as a result of the movements of history that what women were saying to other women and to men too, that women were simply telling a different story, this was a very exciting moment. I still remember the enormous excitement for me of that sense of discovery. And I think that excitement has continued for a great many women, the sense of just discovering things that were invisible to us before, things in literary texts corresponding to what Layla was talking about in the history of Islam, things that just were never seen by anyone have suddenly become visible to us, meaning to women, and through us to men too. It seems to me an enormously thrilling literary as well as political movement.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to the second in a series of discussions about women's literary studies. The panelists are Deborah Kaplan of George Mason University, Patricia Spax of Yale University, Joan Stewart of North Carolina State University, and Layla Ahmed of the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. Professors Spax, Stewart, and Ahmed recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center. Here is Deborah Kaplan.
Part of the feminist critique involves showing that the study of literature is, in fact, a social institution. There are critics who help to create the canon, who create our images of the authors who've written the works that are in the canon. There are critics who help us to know what to think about the works in the canon, who teach us our aesthetic values, and we need to consider who those people are and what values they themselves hold. But the feminist approach not only critiques the social institution of literature, it also, as a consequence of making such a critique, enables feminist critics to try to enter the social institution of literature, to try to take part in what becomes the canon and what kinds of aesthetic values we hold.
Patricia Spax.
I think there are a lot of ways already in which feminist ideas and perspectives are getting into the culture at large, and that is happening increasingly by a kind of geometrical progression, more and more every year. Anthologies are gradually changing. I'm involved in the editing of an anthology of world literature, which has gone through five or six revisions in the past 20 years, and in this revision, more than in any previous one, it is incorporating a good deal of material by women and blacks. The canon is gradually, very, very slowly changing, and the insights of feminist criticism are, I think, very slowly infiltrating the establishment.
Leila Ahmed.
Well, the implications of what we're saying is that one of the crucial dimensions in which feminism has changed literary criticism is that it has abolished the notion that literature has got nothing to do with life and the politics of living. We're not only the ways of looking at the text, but which texts we decide to look at, or who decides what texts are worthy of being looked at, and beyond that question is, well, what are texts but products of society and products which reflect the dynamics within the society, the power dynamics, the sexual dynamics? So, and are we worried about the fallout? Well, we're not worried about it. In fact, our object is partly the fallout on society.
Joan Stewart.
I think that the dissemination of feminist thought is probably being carried on very importantly through the journals and not just through the books, although certainly very important books have appeared in the past few years. And the journal that comes spontaneously to mind is, of course, Signs, which was founded by Catherine Simpson a few years ago, and which has carried very influential articles on feminist criticism. Another journal which also seeks feminist approaches to literature is Critical Inquiry, which in 1981 published a special issue on writing and sexual difference, carrying a number of significant articles. But I think that you're finding feminist articles with feminist orientations in the traditional journals as well.
Patricia Spax.
I think one of the potential problems about women's studies programs and about such first-rate journals, even as Signs and Feminist Studies, is the problem of ghettoizing, which many women are concerned about, the idea that feminist criticism, feminist perspectives are something that belong in a special little pocket of the university or a special journal, and nobody else needs to worry about them. And I think one of the significant developments in women's studies programs in recent years, after all, women's studies programs have been going on now for at least 15 years, one of the recent developments is a movement in various ways in various places to insist on the fact that women's studies is not the concern just of women or just the concern of certain specific courses in the universities, but that this is something which must be taken account of by people teaching all courses in all parts of the university.
Leila Ahmed.
I think one of the things that needs to be cleared up is that the notion that some men have that feminist criticism can only be practiced by women. I can think of at least several, but I can only think of one name at the moment, but there are several that I know of, like Jonathan Culler, who do put the feminist case quite well. And I think it has nothing to do with being a woman, but it is a way of understanding what is what the process. Yes, the feminist criticism doesn't emanate from the female body, but is a way of understanding literature, and therefore it's an intellectual process. It's an moral process, but not a physical process, and it's as accessible to men who wish to avail themselves of it, and more I think of the important critics are availing themselves.
Already, the result of feminist criticism has been that gender is assumed by most people to be one of the significant variables in people, as class and race is considered are considered significant variables. But it was not very long ago that gender was not considered one of the important variables to think about in making critical literary judgments. The fact that important male critics now are beginning to practice something which they themselves call feminist criticism, I think, is an indication of the fact that feminist criticism is perceived in the academy as an important mode, a mode that has to be taken account of.
Yes, you're asking about experience, and what we're talking about is what has been within a dominant culture, literary culture, what has been expressed and allowed to be expressed, and what feminist criticism, one might say, or feminism is doing is saying that what has been canonized as literature does not include much of women's experience. That's one of the things it's saying.
Deborah Kaplan.
We should mention, I think, that there are some very important feminist critics working on black writers, black women writers in particular, finding their tradition in black writing, just as Elaine Showalter has shown, for example, a tradition for 19th and 20th century British women writers, Mary Helen Washington, for example, or Hortense Spillers. Feminist critics working on a black literary tradition for women have found, have helped to discover the novels of wonderful writers like Zora Neale Hurston, and are showing that Hurston is an important predecessor to the works of women writing today, like Walker.
Patricia Spax.
Some people appear to be worried that the enterprise of feminist criticism is an enterprise of indiscriminately opening up the canon to all works by women, and assuming that because they have been ignored, they are necessarily now to be valued. There are differences among feminist critics about questions of value, as there are among other critics about questions of value, and as there are among feminist critics about a great many matters. I think one thing that needs to be said about the question of literary standards from a feminist point of view is that among the questions feminist critics are asking is a series of questions about how standards are arrived at and what standards mean. It's not that they necessarily wish to eliminate standards. Well, it's not. I'll say that more emphatically. They certainly don't wish to eliminate standards. They may wish to question the existing standards and to raise the possibility of other grounds of judgment than those that have been admitted so far.
Joan Stewart.
It seems to me immensely unfair to think of feminist criticism as a way of narrowing the focus through which we look at texts. Quite the contrary is true. It's a way of broadening the focus immensely. Feminist criticism should not be defined, I think, in opposition to men's studies. Feminist criticism is a way of reading not just women in a text, women as subject, women as writers, but men, too. It's a way of reading commentaries on humane existence. It's a way of seeing a good many different things, which include perhaps liberating, if I can use that word, women in texts.
Leila Ahmed.
Quite often it's as if we're answering questions which are seeing feminist criticism as somehow opposed to men. And perhaps one way of seeing it is that it's not opposed to the culture, even to the culture which is by and large dominated by men, but rather is a fulfillment of its own best aspirations, of that culture's highest aspiration, in applying notions of woman as a free and moral being to woman as well as has so far been applied to men.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to the second in a series of conversations about women's literary studies. The panelists included Leila Ahmed of the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, Patricia Spax of Yale University, Joan Stewart of North Carolina State University, and Deborah Kaplan of George Mason University. Next week on Soundings, part 3 of Women's Literary Studies. My guest will be Elaine Showalter of Rutgers University. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join me this week for the second in a series of conversations about women's literary studies. As recent political developments attest, feminism is an important social force in American life, measurable by various yardsticks, among them cultural and literary criticism. What are some of the implications of feminism for the production and study of literature? The Soundings panelists include scholars in women's studies from Yale University, the University of Massachusetts, George Mason University, and North Carolina State University. Women's Studies, Part 2, this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.